upon both Orville and myself. 2. For many, even veteran travelers, the prospect of crossing the Atlantic in the middle of winter would have kept them happily safe and comfortable at home. But Catherine Wright, who had never been to sea, never even set foot on board an ocean liner, seems to have had no misgivings or hesitation whatever. On January 5, 1909, in New York, she and Orville went aboard the German liner Kaiser Wilhelm der Grosse, Orville hobbling up the gangplank as best he could beside her, bound for France. She, who had been so long confined by work and family responsibilities, was now, at last, at age 34, embarking on a venture such as she had only been able to dream of, scarcely imagining it might one day happen. She had made her first visit to the dress shop in Dayton in early December to choose a traveling ensemble and hat, and ultimately packed her trunk with two new evening dresses as well, one pink, the other black. When asked by friends and reporters about the purpose of the trip, she and Orville would say it was for a sort of family reunion. In their absence, Bishop Wright would be looked after by Carrie Grumbach, who, with her husband and child, had moved in with him at 7 Hawthorne Street. Catherine's primary responsibility would be Orville, who was walking now with a cane instead of crutches, but was still quite unsteady on his feet, with a decided limp, and needed somebody with him to make sure he did not fall. Except for one rough day at sea, the crossing turned out to be extremely smooth. Even so, Orville had trouble walking the deck. They were traveling first class, enjoying good service and in pleasant company, as Catherine wrote their father. Clearly, all was as she would wish. They landed at Cherbourg the afternoon of January 11th, and by boat train reached Paris at 1 in the morning to find Wilbur waiting at the station to greet them. In silk hat and evening clothes, no less, Catherine was delighted to record. He had come all the way from Poe, and with him were the Bergs and Arnold Fordyce, who stepped forward to present Catherine with a large bouquet of American Beauty roses, from which protruded an American flag. They all went to the Mirbeer Hotel on the Champs-Élysées near the Berg's apartment. Once the others said good night, the three Wrights sat up talking until 3 in the morning. The following day, the brothers met for lunch with André Michelin, the automobile tire manufacturer, who presented Wilbur with the $4,000 that went with the Michelin Cup. Catherine, meanwhile, went shopping with Edith Berg, a pretty woman and very stylish, Catherine reported to the bishop later that night. She will be down at Poe with me, and that will make it more pleasant. She will take her automobile and take me about in the country. Wilbur and Hart Berg had already left for Poe. She and Orville would follow shortly. Orville asked her also to tell the bishop that as of now, from French syndicate payments, prize money, and cash awards, Wilbur and he had $35,000 in the bank in Paris. Orville and Catherine left Paris for Pau, 194 miles to the south, by overnight train the evening of Friday the 15th. En route at about 7 a.m., the train crashed head-on into a freight train, killing two passengers and seriously injuring a half-dozen others. She and Orville were not even scratched, Catherine assured their father. We happened to take a compartment de luxe, which was all that saved at least one of us from a bad fall. In fact, Orville, while not injured, had been badly shaken up and subjected to severe pain. After a delay of 5 hours, they reached Pau the following afternoon and checked into the Grand Hotel Gassion, next door to the birthplace of France's most popular king, Henry IV. The hotel was grand indeed, and set on the brink of a steep bluff with a commanding view of the green valley below and the spectacular snow-capped peaks of the Pyrenees, some 10,000 feet in elevation, that stretched the length of the horizon approximately 30 miles to the south. To provide further enjoyment of the spectacle, there was also a beautiful promenade, running a mile along the top of the bluff. Never in their lives until now had Catherine and the brothers seen such mountains. "I never saw anything so lovely," wrote Catherine, struggling to find words to express what she felt. Wilbur would not be staying at the hotel, but at a flying field called Pont Long, about 6 miles from the town, or 20 minutes by automobile, where the city fathers had provided him with luxurious living quarters, or at least luxurious by his standards, and with most all the comforts, including his own personal French chef. The chef did not last long, however, Wilbur finding the cuisine too fancy. Neither did a successor satisfy. Finally, a third chef caught on to what the American liked to eat, and all seems to have gone well thereafter. At a reception for the three rites put on by the mayor of Po, some 500 guests gathered in the Po garden at the Grand Hall du Palais d'Hiver at the eastern end of the promenade. Outside the encircling palm trees and flowers, another 1,000 people or more looked on. Wilbur had yet to conduct any of his experiments, but as reported in the Paris Herald, Poe had simply gone mad about aviation. "Nothing is talked about but mechanical flight. Everyone is buying a new camera to snap aeroplanes. Painters are busy at their canvases. The long-neglected roads are being repaired, and society is inviting the Wrights to many more gatherings than they can possibly attend." A few days later, a photograph of Wilbur, Orville, and Catherine, out for a stroll in Poe, appeared on the front page of the Herald. "She and her brothers were the whole show everywhere they went," wrote Catherine. Until a year ago, Wilbur and Orville had worked practically in secret. Now they were the toast of Europe, and she was with them. "Every time we make a move, the people on the street stop and stare at us. We have our pictures taken every 2 minutes." She minded this not in the least. "The Daily Mirror of London had a man here who got a dandy picture of Orv and me." With the onset of February and warmer days came a marked increase in the arrival of notables of the kind Poe was known for, counts and countesses, dukes and duchesses, lords and ladies, many of them English. There were members of the French cabinet, generals, lords of the press, and a number of American millionaires, as well as a former prime minister of England and 2 kings. Never in their lives had the three Wrights been among so many who, by all signs, had little to do but amuse themselves. Nor did they feel out of place or the least intimidated by such company. They felt that they, in their way, were quite as well born and properly reared as anyone. Never did they stray from remaining exactly who they were, and more often than not, they found themselves most pleasantly surprised by those they were meeting. At a luncheon at their hotel, their host, Alfred Harmsworth, Lord Northcliffe, publisher of the London Daily Mail, was much to their liking, though a man worlds apart from Wilbur and Orville. He had immense wealth and all the glamour of power and success, but appealed greatly all the same. Further, he was keenly interested in the development of aviation, and he liked Americans. On another occasion, they were with Joseph Pulitzer, publisher of the New York World, and his wife. "We all liked them very much," wrote Catherine. She wrote also of a rousing good time at lunch with Lord and Lady Balfour. Arthur Balfour, former Prime Minister of England, was so eager to take part in preparations for Wilbur's flights at Pont Long that along with Lord Northcliffe he helped haul on the rope that lifted the catapult weight into place. Seeing a young British lord also assisting, Northcliffe remarked to Orville, who was standing close by watching, "I am so glad that young man is helping with the rope, for I am sure it is the only useful thing he has ever done in his life." Catherine had the thrill of a day's expedition to the Pyrenees by automobile with a wealthy Irish couple, and as she reported to her father, knowing how it would please him, she had begun taking French lessons for 2 hours every morning, and with her background in Greek and Latin, her progress was rapid. One of those helping her with her French was the son of Prime Minister Georges Clemenceau. Another she greatly liked was the Comtesse de Lambert, the attractive wife of Wilbur's student, the Comte de Lambert. Her complaints were few. On those days when there was no sun, the cold and dampness were such as she did not care for. Besides, Edith Berg, whom she had liked at first in Paris, was getting on her nerves. She was a regular tyrant, and as selfish as anyone can be. We will be glad when she goes. But to judge by her letters, that was as wrathy as Catherine turned during the time in Europe, and though Edith Berg stayed on, Catherine appears to have had no further complaints about her. More press arrived, more photographs were taken, more articles written for Le Figaro, the Paris Herald, the London Daily Mail, the New York Times, and papers back in Ohio. One story sent by the United Press from Paris claimed a French army lieutenant had charged Wilbur in a divorce case. The story was a complete fabrication that none of the French papers carried, but in Dayton, where it did appear, it caused a temporary embarrassing sensation. Wilbur wrote an angry denial. Family and friends at home rose quickly to his defense, saying he was not that sort of man. Since arriving in Paris in January, Orville had told reporters that given his physical state, it would be foolish for him to attempt any exertion. At Pau, he mainly stood and watched, saying little. With his derby hat, well-pressed suit, his polished shoes and cane, he could have been another of the European aristocrats. A writer for Flyer magazine, H. Massick Buist, was surprised to see how small Orville was, indeed how different both brothers were from what he had expected, judging from press accounts. I have never seen them taciturn or curt or secretive, or any of the other things which I had been led to believe were their outstanding characteristics. Recalling a line attributed to Wilbur, "Well, if I talked a lot, I should be like a parrot, which is the bird that speaks most and flies least." Buist wrote that in the course of a day, Wilbur talked quite as much as most men. The difference was, his words were to the point. The less Orville had to say, the more Catherine talked, and with great effect. She had become a celebrity in her own right. The press loved her. The masters of the aeroplane, those two clever and intrepid Daytonians, who have moved about Europe under the spotlight of extraordinary publicity, have had a silent partner, went one account. But silent she was no longer, and reporters delighted in her extroverted, totally unaffected Midwestern American manner. Some of what was written went too far. She was said to have mathematical genius, superior even to that of her brothers, and that she was the one financing their time in Europe. In the main, however, it was full-hearted, long-overdue public recognition of the mainstay of her brothers in their efforts. Who was it who gave them new hope when they began to think the problem of flight impossible? Who was it that nursed Orville back to strength and health when the physicians had practically given him up after that fatal accident last September? Besides, wrote one correspondent, like most American girls, the aviator's sister has very decided views of her own. Wilbur made his first flight at Pau on February 3, and from that day on remained a sensation. As said one headline, all Pau was agog. Virtually every day but Sunday, a steady stream of elegant carriages and automobiles headed out to the flying field to see the doors of the huge red aerodoc swing wide and the four-year-old flyer come rolling out, showing signs of much wear and tear. The canvas soiled and torn, patched and tattooed with tin tacks. Wilbur would examine it up and down with his usual care, oil can in hand, pockets bulging with twine, a screwdriver, a wrench, touching a wire here, a bolt there, and never hurrying. Then, with all to his liking, off he would go, right up into the air, turning, wheeling up and down, graceful as an albatross, showing the perfect command of the aviator. For a second or two, the plane would seem to hang motionless against the high white line of the snow-capped Pyrenees, absolutely a scene of beauty quite impossible to describe. One of the few problems to contend with was the ground filled with bumps, some the size of a bowler hat, that made takeoffs difficult. Someone suggested that with a bit of spade work, the ground could be leveled. It was just what Wilbur and Orville had done preparing for their first test flights at Huffman Prairie. But Wilbur by now felt he could dispense with that. "If we have to alter the face of the earth before we can fly," he replied, "we may as well throw up the proposition." Such was the way of the man, observed a writer who was present. He never sought to escape by the easy way round. Most of Wilbur's time was devoted to training the Comte de Lambert and another French aviator he was expected to teach, Paul Tissandier. Like de Lambert, Tissandier was a wealthy aristocrat who had been an automobile racer before taking up aviation. The third student was a French army officer, Captain Paul N. Lucas Gerardville. Of the three, de Lambert was the best pilot and Wilbur's favorite. In none of his flights at Pont-Long was Wilbur attempting to set a record, and so other passengers, too, went aloft seated beside him, as many as a dozen altogether, including Catherine, who went up before a large crowd on February 15, just as night was coming on. It was her first time in the air. A spell of cold weather had set in. Southern sunny France is a delusion and a snare, she had told her father. But all that was forgotten when Wilbur at long last invited her to go with him. She was most happily surprised by how smoothly they sailed along and how easily she could recognize faces below. She thought they were flying at about 30 feet, but found out later it was 60 feet. And they were moving at 42 miles per hour. Yet she had a feeling of complete tranquility and forgot completely about the cold. The flight lasted 7 minutes. To show her the ease with which he could maneuver the machine, Wilbur made several sharp turns, but again she experienced no ill effects and never showed the least sign of fear. Asked later if she had felt like a bird when flying with her brother, Catherine responded, "I don't know exactly how a bird feels. Birds sing, I suppose, because they are happy. I sang, I know, and I was very happy indeed, but like the birds, I sang best after the flight was over." By now Wilbur was making flights with passengers 5 or 6 times a day. Who got to go was entirely up to him, and while it was assumed by many that he was charging a fee for so rare a privilege, and many were prepared to pay, and pay handsomely, he charged nothing, which made a great impression. When a wealthy American from Philadelphia was told by Lord Northcliffe that only Wilbur decided who went with him, the man replied, "Oh, I dare say that can be arranged." "I would like to be around when you do the arranging, just to see how it's done," Northcliffe replied. The man did not get his ride. Northcliffe would later say he never knew more unaffected people than Wilbur, Orville, and Catherine Wright, and that he did not think the excitement over them and the intense interest produced by their extraordinary feats had any effect on them whatsoever. Catherine filled her assignment as social manager for the brothers to perfection, taking an active part in all manner of events night and day, and availing herself of every opportunity to make use of her rapidly improving French. "I understand a great deal now and talk fairly well," she told her father. That neither of her brothers had made such an effort annoyed him greatly. "A year in France and not understand or speak French," he had written in reference to Wilbur in particular. It was about as critical as the bishop ever was when it came to Wilbur. In addition, the brothers depended on Catherine to maintain correspondence with her father, and so she did, sending off letters and postcards several times a week. In more than a month's time at Poe, Orville never wrote a word to the bishop, while Wilbur wrote only once, on March 1, to say he would be going to Rome next, that Orville was much better than when he arrived, though still not entirely himself, and that he, Wilbur, would be very glad to get back home again. For his part, Bishop Wright kept them regularly posted on events at home, his health, which was good, Carrie Grumbach's cooking, also good, his travels on church work, the weather, and the fact that he was not a bit lonely. He had too much to do. He had begun work on an autobiography, and had already produced 14 typewritten pages. A few weeks later, he was up to 50 pages. As noted in the press, the airfield at Pont-Long continued to shine as a place of pilgrimage for men of eminence. In the last week of February, the King of Spain, Alfonso XIII, arrived to witness the miracle. He watched Wilbur take off and fly high above in great circles, never taking his eye off the spectacle. Afterward, as his entourage, Orville, Catherine, and others, crowded around, he stood close to hear Wilbur explain each of the control mechanisms on the machine. The king, who spoke English and clearly knew a good deal about aviation, had many questions for Wilbur. At one point, turning to Catherine, he asked, "And did you really ride it yourself?" When she said she had, he said he wanted very much to go up with Wilbur, but had promised his wife he would not. Catherine judged him a good husband. Turning to Wilbur, the king inquired whether it would be asking too much to request another demonstration. "I have seen what you can do," he said. "I want to see what one of your pilots can do." Wilbur at once consented, taking off this time with the Comte de Lambert for a flight of 12 minutes, during which Wilbur never once touched the levers. That a student pilot could have learned to handle the plane with such skill in such a short time seemed to impress the king more than anything. Orville had told the press he would do no flying while in France, nor did he plan to go up with Wilbur. But only days later, Wilbur took Catherine for another ride, this time for a 13-mile flight cross-country. "It was great," she told her father. Not long after that, she would take off in a balloon with a French count, and this time Orville went too, sailing some 30 miles to land at Ossen in the Pyrenees. That accomplished, Catherine gave out. Close to collapse from too much excitement, she stayed in her hotel room for 2 days. On March 17, the most beautiful day yet, royal weather, as people were saying, the King of England arrived, having driven more than 70 miles over to Pau from his customary holiday headquarters at Biarritz, and with a considerable royal party accompanying him in a stream of gleaming black automobiles. Edward VII was in his 68th year, a stout, white-bearded, affable figure, whose enjoyment of life, whose manner of dress, the Homburg hats, tweed suits, the habit of never buttoning the bottom button on his vest, along with his love of fast automobiles and unmasked enthusiasm for beautiful women, had led to his being taken as a kind of emblem for the years since 1900, the Edwardian era. The oldest son of Queen Victoria, he was an altogether refreshing personification of escape from the Victorian age. That he was also keenly interested in aviation and had come in person to witness for himself the wonder of Wilbur Wright seemed entirely in keeping. The crowd at the airfield was large, the excitement great. Catherine was presented to the king, who, as noticed, was wearing a small bunch of shamrock in his buttonhole, in honor of St. Patrick's Day. He was taken first to see the flyer inside the shed. Wilbur apologized for the plane's worn appearance, but was proud to point to the very spick-and-span new flyer being built right beside it, which, Wilbur explained, was to be used in Rome. As Wilbur saw to the positioning of his plane on the field and did his final inspection, Orville explained its workings to the king. Then Wilbur took off, performed to perfection, and after about 7 minutes made a perfect landing at the point where he took off. The king watched it all with bated breath, as he said. As he had for King Alfonso, Wilbur offered to go again to show how he carried a passenger, and once again Catherine went with him. She had by now flown longer and farther than had any American woman. Later that same day, much to the pride of all three Wrights, and to every French man and woman in the crowd, the Comte de Lambert performed a solo flight. The clamor and amazement over what the Wrights had achieved, all they had shown to be true, time after time, at Le Mans and Po, was by no means limited to Europe. At home in the United States, newspapers and magazines from one end of the country to the other gave the story continual attention. Nor was the potential of so miraculous a creation lost sight of. In a long article in the Waco, Texas Times-Herald on the monarchs of the air, James A. Edgerton wrote as follows. Most of us can remember when the automobile was a novelty. The writer is under 40, yet recalls the time when the first horseless wagon was used, and it was only about a score of years ago. The machine was a big, clumsy affair with large wheels, uncertain steering apparatus, and was run by a very noisy steam engine. This was so great a failure that it was some years before another crossed my field of vision. Now they are as common as millionaires. If the automobile could be so vastly improved in so short a time, who can predict what may occur in the field of aerial navigation now that the principle has actually been discovered and is before the world? Is it not possible that it will revolutionize human affairs in as radical a way as did the discovery of the use of steam? In all this stupendous change going on before our very eyes, the Wright brothers are the chief magicians. They are the leaders and pioneers. It had been announced that the Aero Club of America would present the brothers with a gold medal on their return. Congress, too, had voted a medal to be presented by President William Howard Taft, and Dayton was making preparations for the biggest celebration in its history. But for all the attention being paid to the Wrights, there was at the same time increasing realization of how much else was happening in aviation in France. 6 months earlier, the number of builders of airplanes in Paris and vicinity amounted to less than a half dozen. On April 25, the New York Times reported that no fewer than 15 factories were now in full operation. If the Wrights were front and center in the show of the inventive change, the cast on stage in France was filling rapidly. Scores of inventors are constructing their own machines, the Times article continued. There's an aerodrome where pupils are taught to fly. Three new papers devoted to aviation have been founded within the past 6 months. There are three societies in France for the encouragement of aviation, and over $300,000 in prizes will be open to competition in the course of the year. The largest of the competitive events, an international flying meet, was scheduled for the coming summer in the town of Reims, northeast of Paris in the Champagne country. 3. With his demonstrations concluded at Po, Wilbur spent his final few days there packing the new flyer for shipment in sections to Rome. The flyer used at Le Mans and Po would ultimately wind up in a museum in Paris, and supervising the final stages of training for his French students to the point where all three had soloed. Orville and Catherine had already returned to Paris, and on March 23, Wilbur, too, left Po for Paris. A few days later, the three Wrights went to Le Mans to be received at a heartwarming farewell banquet. 3 days after that, Wilbur and Hart Berg were on board a train from Paris to Rome, where, a week later, Orville and Catherine were to join them. In Paris, to Catherine's delight, the social pace continued full speed. As she informed her father, she was the only woman ever invited to a dinner at the Aero Club de France. "You ought to seen it," she wrote in the Ohio vernacular. "Me, sitting up there big as you, talking French as lively as anyone. It was a performance, I can tell you." Best of all, she also told the bishop, he had been toasted. "They drank a champagne in your honor." Catherine and Orville left for Rome on April 9 and arrived the next afternoon to find the city overrun with tourists, including an estimated 30,000 Americans. Apparently, no one had prepared them for such crowds. Hotels, restaurants, monuments, and museums were swarming with people. Hart Berg had found rooms for Orville and Catherine opposite the Barberini Palace. Wilbur was staying several miles south of the city at a flying field called Centocelle, but instead of a shed this time, he was living in a nearby cottage on an estate belonging to a countess. In terms of the purpose for which the rites had come there, Rome was an unqualified success. From April 15 to the 26th, Wilbur completed more than 50 flights, all to great acclaim and without mishap. He trained Italian military officers how to fly his plane, lectured to school teachers and students, and took a variety of passengers for a ride, one of whom, a news cameraman, produced the first motion picture films ever shot from an airplane in flight. The weather was ideal, and as in France, large crowds watched in amazement. And again, there was no shortage of prominent figures among the onlookers. King Victor Emmanuel III of Italy strolled about with a camera slung over his shoulder as though one of the tourists. There were princes, dukes, cabinet members, the American financier J.P. Morgan and his sister and daughter, and James J. Hill, the famous American railroad builder. The American ambassador to Italy, Lloyd Griscom, was one of those who went flying with Wilbur. But for Orville and Catherine, Rome, after the time they had had in France, left much to be desired. That April was the choice season in Rome, that the palaces of the Caesars, the Arch of Constantine, and the Colosseum were even more impressive than expected, was not sufficient. As Catherine told her father, "I was homesick for the first time when we reached Rome." She and Orville both were very anxious to come home. She found their hotel appallingly dirty. "We would appreciate a good clean bathtub and clean plates and knives and forks, much more than the attention we receive." In another letter she reported, "The waiters at the table are so dirty that I can hardly eat a mouthful of food." She and Orville thought J.P. Morgan, his sister and daughter, pleasant enough, but were growing weary of the ways of the aristocracy. When the word came that Victor Emmanuel would be arriving at Centocelle Field at 8 in the morning to see Wilbur fly, it only went to prove that kings could be a nuisance. "They always come at such unearthly hours," wrote Catherine. A lunch in honor of the three rites at the beautiful villa of the Contessa Celeri, who was providing Wilbur's living quarters, was all quite fine, as was the drive provided for their enjoyment into the countryside in a brand-new elegant automobile, until the chauffeur, taking a curve at breakneck speed, smashed head-on into a stone wall. Fortunately, no one was hurt, though the car was a total wreck. Brother Wilbur was quite well, Catherine was pleased to report to the bishop. Orville, too, was looking well and improves all the time, but, like me, doesn't care much for the discomforts of Rome. They would be heading to London by way of Paris, then on to New York as soon as possible. After 2 days in London, where they were feted and honored still further, a banquet at the Ritz Hotel, the first ever gold medal awarded by the British Aeronautical Society, the three sailed on May 5 from Southampton on the German ocean liner Chrome Prinzessin Cecilie. For Wilbur, it was the end of just over a year in Europe, much the greater part of which had been spent in France. It was there in France, beginning at Le Mans, that he had flown as no man ever had anywhere on earth. At Le Mans and Pau, he had flown far more than anyone ever had, and set every record for distance, speed, altitude, time in the air, and made the first flights ever with a passenger, and all this after so many years of near secrecy of his and Orville's efforts had been done for all to see. The whole world now knew. The threesome had also become far richer financially. The time in Europe had resulted in an accumulated compensation from contracts and prizes of some $200,000. Wilbur had also found among the French a wealth of friendship such as he had never known. As he would write much later in a letter of gratitude to Léon Bollée, "We do not forget that you expended much time and gave yourself much trouble in order to be of assistance to us, and that you rejoiced with us in our successes and grieved with us in our troubles. These were not things to compensate for with money, but we cherish them forever in our hearts." For Orville, the four-month-long grand tour had provided a greatly needed change of scene and the chance to recuperate at his own pace. For Catherine, it was a colossal reward for all she had done for her brothers for so long in so many ways. Further, as would become increasingly clear later, they had seen Europe at an almost perfect time, when prosperity and peace prevailed, when Americans in abundance were discovering and enjoying the experience of European travel and the changes in outlook it brought as never before, and when the horrors of modern mechanized warfare were still to come. Travelers from all parts of America who were there then would never forget the time, nor would the three Wrights, nor were they ever again to enjoy such a time together. For now, for all three, there was the overriding good feeling of being homeward bound. Chapter 11. Causes for Celebration. Telegram from Catherine, telling of their safe arrival in New York, saying they will be home Thursday. Bishop Wright's Diary, Tuesday, May 11, 1909. 1. After a rousing welcome at New York, with a chorus of harbor whistles blaring as their ship came in, and a swarm of reporters and photographers surrounding their every move during a one-day stopover in the city, the three Wrights went on by train to Dayton, arriving at Union Depot Thursday, May 13, 1909, at 5 p.m. The crowd at the station was of a size rarely seen in Dayton. Cannons were booming, factory whistles blowing across town, everyone at the station cheering. Seeing Bishop Wright as she and her brothers stepped from the train, Catherine shouted, "Oh, there's Daddy," and rushed to throw her arms around him. Wilbur and Orville then warmly embraced their father, but so wild was the noise, no one could hear what was being said. There were more embraces for Lauren and Netta and their children. Then, as they began inching their way through the crowd, Wilbur and Orville started shaking hands. Seeing a big veteran member of the Dayton police force, Tom Mitchell, Wilbur said, "Hello, Tom." "Good boy," said Tom, as he took Wilbur by the hand. Catherine was described in one account as looking like the typical American girl at a homecoming, in a smart gray traveling gown with a large broad-brimmed picture hat of dark green. The only woman in the world who had made three flights in an airplane, she was now as much a subject of attention nearly as her brothers. In New York she had lectured reporters on some of the flippant accounts that had appeared in the American press about the notable Europeans who had taken an interest in her brothers. She loved America, she said, but the American people did not always understand Europeans, who were an appreciative people. She could not listen to anyone saying unkind things about them without protesting. But here in the noise and the crowds of the moment, there was no call for such comment. Wilbur looked bronzed and hard, and Orville, too, looked well, certainly a great deal better than when he had left Dayton in January, but walked still with a limp. In the middle of all that was happening, Bishop Wright, as was noted, rarely spoke a word, but feasted his eyes on the two sons who had made the name Wright, as well as Dayton, known to the world. 11 carriages awaited at the entrance to the station to carry the family and a variety of town officials to Hawthorne Street, each of the three reserved for the Wrights, pulled by 4 white horses. The bishop and Orville rode in the first, Wilbur and Richland in the second, Catherine, Lauren, and Lauren's family in the third. The streets were filled with more crowds the whole way. Sidewalks were packed. People were leaning from windows, children waving small flags. Hawthorne Street and the Wright homestead were bedecked with flags and flowers and Japanese lanterns. Standing at last at the railing of the front porch, Catherine called out to neighbors across the street, "I'm so glad to get home, I don't know what to do." For considerable time, she and the brothers stood in the front parlor, receiving a steady procession of old friends and neighbors. Outside, the crowd grew to more than 10,000. The day after, Mayor Edward Burkhard and several city officials called at 7 Hawthorne Street to discuss with the family the real celebration to come. Speaking with a local reporter only shortly afterward, Orville said quite matter-of-factly that though his doctors had told him he was to do no flying in Europe, and that he had obeyed them to the letter, he would soon resume his flights at Fort Myer. As he did not say, Wilbur and Catherine felt strongly that a return to the scene of the crash now would put too great a strain on him. He should wait until he was back in practice. But to Orville the matter was settled. Fort Myer it had to be, and he was ready. The Wright Workshop on West 3rd Street became a beehive of industry no less than ever, with Charlie Taylor in charge. "The most important thing we have before us at this time is to get ready for the Fort Myer tests," Wilbur told reporters, and he and Orville personally were constructing the plane to be used there. The old machine had been so badly broken up in the crash that all but the motor and transmission was being built anew. On May 20, it was announced that President Taft would soon be presenting the brothers several medals at the White House. Catherine was to go with them to Washington for the ceremony, of course. Bishop Wright, however, felt obliged to take part in some church work in Indiana. To attract as little attention as possible, the brothers and Catherine quietly left Dayton on an earlier train than expected, and no notice was taken except for a few railroad officials at the depot. They were to remain in Washington only the day of June 10. There was a lunch in their honor at the Cosmos Club, which, for the occasion, waived its long-standing policy of men only, so Catherine could attend. Prominent among the more distinguished Washingtonians present was Alexander Graham Bell. Shortly after the lunch, the entire party walked the short distance to the White House, where nearly 1,000 men and women stood in the East Room as President Taft formally presented 2 gold medals on behalf of the Aero Club of America. At 6'2" and weighing 300 pounds, the president loomed large as he stood beside the brothers. In addressing his 2 fellow Ohioans, he spoke appropriately to the point and with unmistakable warmth. "I esteem it a great honor and an opportunity to present these medals to you as an evidence of what you have done. I am so glad, perhaps at a delayed hour, to show that in America it is not true that a prophet is not without honor save in his own country. It is especially gratifying thus to note a great step in human discovery by paying honor to men who bear it so modestly. You made this discovery by a course that we of America like to feel is distinctly American, by keeping your noses right at the job until you had accomplished what you had determined to do." By evening, the 3 Wrights were back on board the train on their way back to Dayton. Thorough testing of new propellers had become a primary requirement. In the meantime, however, there was Dayton's real celebration, the great homecoming, to be faced, like it or not. Gigantic was the word used to describe the preparations. The whole story of America and Dayton from earliest times was to be portrayed with historical exactness in a parade of enormous floats being built at the National Cash Register plant. Indians and their canoes, the eras of the Conestoga wagon, the canal boat, the first railroad, Robert Fulton's steamboat, the evolution of the bicycle, and an up-to-date automobile, would be followed by the first American balloon and a dirigible. All this in prelude to a float titled, "All the World Paying Homage to the United States, the Wright Brothers and the Airplane," and featuring a handcrafted, half-size replica of a Wright flyer. There were to be 15 floats, and 560 people in costume, all historically correct, in what the newspapers promised to be the greatest parade Dayton had ever beheld. On Main Street, a court of honor was being created, reaching from 3rd Street to the river, white columns lining both sides of the street and strung with colored lights. Everywhere is the tri-colored bunting. Everywhere flutters the pennants and flags and banners, the papers were saying. Soldiers, sailors, and the fire department would march. Bands play. Some 2,500 schoolchildren, dressed in red, white, and blue, would be arranged as a living flag on the fairgrounds grandstand and sing the Star-Spangled Banner. In the nearly 10 years that the Wright brothers had been working to achieve success with their invention, this was to be the first formal recognition by their hometown of their efforts and success, and there was to be no mistaking the whole town's enthusiasm. While little of such elaborate fanfare appealed to the brothers, they knew that if Dayton saw fit to celebrate, if Dayton felt that was important, then it was not for them to complain or appear in any way annoyed or disapproving. Octave Chanute wrote to Wilbur to say he knew such honors could grow oppressive to modest men, but then they had brought it on themselves with their ingenuity and courage. It was well-meant advice, but the brothers had no need to be reminded. On the eve of the opening of the festivities, the Dayton Daily News ran an editorial expressing much that was felt by a great many. It is a wonderful lesson, this celebration. It comes at an auspicious time. The old world was getting tired, it seemed, and needed help to whip it into action. There was beginning a great deal of talk about man's no longer having the opportunities he once had of achieving greatness. Too many people were beginning to believe that all of the world's problems had been solved. Money was beginning to tell in the affairs of men, and some were wondering whether a poor boy might work for himself a place in commerce or industry or science. This celebration throws all such idle talk to the winds. It crowns anew the efforts of mankind. It crushes for another 100 years the suspicion that all of the secrets of nature have been solved, or that the avenues of hope have been closed to those who would win new worlds. It points out to the ambitious young man that he labors not in vain, that genius knows no class, no condition. The modesty of the Wright brothers is a source of a good deal of comment. But above all, there is a sermon in their life of endeavor which cannot be preached too often. The following morning, Thursday, June 17, at 9 o'clock, every church bell and factory whistle announced the start of what was to be a 2-day celebration. Thousands of people poured into the city. Business had been suspended, except for the sale of ice cream and flags and toy airships and Wright Brothers postcards. That it was raining lightly the first part of the first day seemed to matter little to anyone. And the show was all that had been expected, one spectacle following another. There were marching bands, concerts, the presentation of medals and the keys to the city. A line of 80 automobiles, all the newest model touring cars, streamed across the Main Street Bridge and down through the Court of Honor. The parade of historical floats, the greatest street procession ever held in Dayton, stretched 2 miles. There were laudatory speeches in abundance, and Wilbur and Orville, Catherine and Bishop Wright were to be seen prominently present on platforms and reviewing stands. The second day, the bishop delivered a brief but eloquent invocation in tribute to his sons. "We have met this day to celebrate an invention, the dream of all ages, hitherto deemed impracticable. It suddenly breaks on all human vision that man, cleaving the air like a bird, can rise to immense heights and reach immeasurable distances. And we come to thee, our Father, to ask thy peace to rest on this occasion and thy benediction on every heart participating in this assembly." Amazingly, all through both days, and as very few were aware, Wilbur and Orville managed to slip deftly in and out of the picture, back and forth to their West 3rd Street shop, one of the few buildings in town that remained undecorated and where work went on. A correspondent for the New York Times, who kept close watch on them, provided a memorable chronology of how they spent the first day. 9 a.m. Left their work in the airplane shop and in their shirt sleeves went out in the street to hear every whistle and bell in town blow and ring for 10 minutes. 9:10 a.m. Returned to work. 10 a.m. Drove in a parade to the opening ceremony of the homecoming celebration. 11 a.m. Returned to work. Noon. Reunion at dinner with Bishop Milton Wright, the father, Miss Catherine Wright, the sister, Ruchlin Wright of Tonganoxie, Kansas, a brother, and Lauren Wright, another brother. 2:30 p.m. Reviewed a parade given in their honor in the downtown streets. 4 p.m. Worked 2 hours packing up parts of an airplane for shipment to Washington. 8 p.m. Attended a public reception and shook hands with as many Daytonians as could get near them. 9 p.m. Saw a pyrotechnical display on the riverfront in which their own portraits, 80 feet high and entwined in an American flag, were shown. It was estimated that in the course of the fireworks, Wilbur and Orville shook hands with more than 5,000 people, and according to the Daily News, only the instinct of self-preservation compelled them to cease. Less than 48 hours later, the festivities at an end, the brothers were packed and on the train to Washington to resume the trials at Fort Myer. Shipment of the plane had been taken care of. Charlie Taylor was already on the scene. 2. It was 6:30, the extremely warm evening of June 26, as Wilbur and Orville sat waiting on the starting rail in the parade ground at Fort Myer. Beside them, their white wing machine stood ready for flight. Farther off, behind a rope at the edge of the field, some 4,000 people, including men of known importance to the nation, stood, according to one account, pawing the ground for something to happen. Hundreds of them had been there since 3 o'clock. The Senate had adjourned so its members could see the flight. Others waiting included high-ranking Army officers, ambassadors, the son of the President, Charlie Taft, and Speaker of the House, Joseph Cannon, whose word, as said, was open sesame to the Treasury vaults. Wilbur had assigned to himself full responsibility for seeing that all was in order. Given the heat, he had dispensed with his customary coat and tie. His hands and face were grimy, his work trousers grease-stained, and perspiration streamed down his face. Orville, by contrast, was described as looking natty as the prize guest of a yachting party. His coat was buttoned tightly about his slender form, as if it were a mistake about its being hot, wrote the Washington Herald. Altogether, he exhaled the atmosphere of a man who finds himself on the top layer of the upper crust of the creme de la creme of all that is worthwhile. The brothers were waiting for the wind to settle down. Again, the wind would be the deciding factor. The wind would have the final say, no matter that most of the United States Senate and several thousand others were being kept waiting. Orville got up and walked away toward the shed, looking nervous. Then Wilbur walked off a while. Then both returned to sit again and chat with a small group of Army officers. "She's blowing at a 16-mile clip," Wilbur told an inquiring reporter. "That's far too stiff for a first flight with a new machine." He looked windward again and sniffed the air. "Take her back to the shed," he said. There is always an element of uncertainty in aviation, as far as it has advanced, Wilbur explained to a writer for the Washington Post. "People must remember that this machine has never been flown before, and also that my brother has not been up in the air since his accident last year. They can't blame me for wanting the first flight to be made under conditions as nearly ideal as possible." No one with a keen sense of dramatic effect, wrote the Washington Herald, could have created a better scene to demonstrate the utter immunity of the two brothers from the fumes of importunity and the intoxication of an august assemblage. Uniformed army signalmen gathered like pallbearers and wheeled the plane away, and 4,000 spectators departed, many expressing opinions, including one senator who was heard to say of the brothers, "I'm damned if I don't admire their independence. We don't mean anything to them, and there are a whole lot of reasons why we shouldn't." That same day, Bishop Wright and Brother Ruchlin arrived in Washington, the bishop having acquired 2 new suits and 2 new shirts for the expedition. Late the afternoon of June 29, Wilbur had no quarrels with the weather, and shortly before 6 o'clock, Orville finally took to the air. The crowd, noticeably smaller than 3 days before, but still numbering several thousand, saw the plane waver, struggling as it skimmed over the grass for no more than 75 feet. Then at a height of about 15 feet, tilt sharply to the right, and its wing touched the ground, at which point Orville cut the engine, and the machine came down in a cloud of dust. A second and third flight were hardly better. Finally, on the fourth try, a flight lasting all of 40 seconds, the plane reached an altitude of 25 feet and took a turn down the field and back. Still, it was enough to evoke cheers and automobile horns. Orville and Wilbur were both in fine spirits now, perfectly confident the machine would prove a success, and that Orville would remain at the controls. He would do no flying at Fort Myer, Wilbur told reporters. That was Orville's job. But, being Big Brother, he would do the bossing. A machine was like a horse, Wilbur said. If it's new, you have to get used to it before it will do just as you want it to. You have to learn its peculiarities. As a result of the day's test flights, it was discovered that one important peculiarity was that the ignition, or sparker, was being shaken loose by vibrations, and thus the motor had too little power. The next 2 days, while Wilbur, Orville, and Charlie Taylor worked on the engine, the bishop and Ruchlin went to the Smithsonian to look at all manner of birds, ostrich, emu, condor, etc., as the bishop recorded in his diary. Another day, when Orville took off again, the plane climbed only 20 feet, and after a distance of 200 feet, hit the ground hard enough to smash one skid. Then on July 2, at an elevation of 80 to 100 feet, and at about the same point over the hangar where the propeller had broken the previous September and Orville's plane had plunged to the ground, the engine suddenly stopped dead. And though this time he was able to glide nicely down, he hit a small thorn tree, ripping open a good-sized portion of the plane's lower wing fabric. Then the machine fell heavily, breaking both skids. Fortunately, Orville was not hurt. Again, as the previous September, reporters and some of the spectators rushed to the crash, as did Wilbur, who, seeing a photographer by the wrecked plane, lost his noted self-control, just as he had with the photographer at Le Mans, picked up a stick and threw it at the man, then demanded he turn over the exposed photographic plate, which he did. It had not been a good day. Wilbur would later apologize to the photographer, who, it turned out, was an official with the War Department. But the brothers had had more than a little experience with adversity, and, as so often before, refused to give up. The next day, Orville went off to Dayton to prepare a new wing covering, and by July 7 was back at Fort Myer, where the work resumed. On July 21st, Catherine arrived to join the brothers, and that afternoon watched Orville make a short, 10-minute flight at an estimated speed of 44 miles per hour, or faster than Wilbur had ever flown in Europe, as she happily reported to those at home. On July 25th, a Sunday, and as customary a day off for the Wright brothers, came stunning news. in a frail, underpowered monoplane, his number 11, the French aviator Louis Blériot had flown the English